I have no special talent. I'm only passionately curious. That is a quote by Albert Einstein. Welcome to the Hidden Why podcast, episode 369 with Judson Brewer. G'day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. My name is Lee Martinuzzi, the host of the show, The Hidden Why Guy, here to attempt to inspire you to live your life with greater passion and purpose. That is certainly my mission. And as I take my learnings and experiences, I want to share and offer you guys some value as well to help you on your journey. I believe it's about connecting within, discovering our why, and using that to navigate ourselves towards greater freedom, fulfillment, and happiness. Today's chat with Judson Brewer is unbelievable. I got so much value out of it. I just absolutely loved it. There's so much depth to it and so much we didn't cover, but certainly for what we covered, I think you can just really explore that in your own time and go deeper with it. I really think it can help just make life more beautiful. And certainly in my experience, it has helped me. And this certainly just clarifies a few of the points that I certainly have had questions about in recent times. So Judson Brewer, who is he? He is a thought leader in the field of habit change and the science of self-mastery. He's combined nearly 20 years of experience with mindfulness training and scientific research. He's a psychologist and an internationally known expert in mindfulness training and addictions. He's based or created both in-person and app-based treatments and programs, as you'll find out in this episode, to help people deal with habit change. He's got a lot of insight into neurology and the workings of the mind, because he was just fascinated with how his mind works. So he continued down that track and explored the deep realms of the mind. And it's really fascinating stuff. And I certainly believe, and as he said, one of his key takeouts for this show was, you know, the best thing we can do to seek change is better understand the mind. And certainly that's been the case for my life. It's been improved by my ability to better understand my mind. Guys, you'll get a lot out of this episode. And if you do, I would love you to share it with your network, share the love, share it with your families, and link up with Judson. You can check out his website using the show notes at thehiddenwhy.com. It's all there. So check it out. Thank him for coming on this show. Connect with him if you're interested in changing some habits, perhaps giving up smoking or controlling your eating. Perhaps you might want to check out the apps as well. Guys, really inspiring conversation. So insightful. I loved it. I'm sure you will. Without further ado, here is Judson Brewer. G'day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Hidden Why podcast. My name is Lee Martinuzzi, and I'm pumped and excited today. I have Judson Brewer on the line with me. Judson, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Now, I understand it's coming to the end of your day over there. Have you had a meal yet, your dinner?
I have.
Have you? And what did you eat? Anything exciting?
Nothing tremendously exciting. We had some nice chili chocolate for desserts. That was nice.
Chili chocolate. Okay, nice. A little bit of chili chocolate, mate. Spice things up a little bit in the taste buds in the evening. It's always a good way to wrap up the day. So tell me, Judson, what really drives you? What are you passionate about?
Understanding how our minds work. That is endlessly fascinating.
Yeah, so, and I've watched a few of your YouTube videos. I absolutely love your presentations. You're a classy stand-up speaker, that's for sure. But the messages and the knowledge you have is what's really powerful as well. Why is the mind fascinating to you? Why understanding the mind? Why has that been a pursuit of yours?
There's something about, you know, I've always been a scientist at heart. I think ever since I was a little kid, I wanted to understand how things worked. So I would, you know, I'd dismantle my toys so I could, you know, understand how they worked and kind of moved, you know, on from there. In college, I studied chemistry, really trying to understand how the molecules of life worked, and moved into higher organisms, you know, animals. And then and I think the final frontier is really the human mind, you know, what drives us to do what we do every day.
Mm. Absolutely. Look, it's something that is quite powerful as to the quality of life we live. And I'm very passionate about, you know, reducing the suffering in my life and the impact that I have on others. And certainly that comes from understanding my mind. And certainly I've delved into, you know, mindfulness, and I'm not a scientist like you are, but I'm slowly figuring things out, and it's really complex and hard to understand at times, but the simplicity of it is also very powerful as well, I think. So I know you've got a new book that I want to chat about called The Craving Mind. Is that just been released, has it?
Yes, just last month.
Okay, and give us a little bit of a brief of what that book's about and why you wrote it.
You know, I was really blown away. I started meditating myself at the beginning of my first day of medical school, and was really, you know, as I went through learning how human physiology and all that through medical school, was in parallel kind of doing my own self-study, understanding my own mind, and actually shifted my entire career from molecular biology and immunology into neuroscience and translational neuroscience around addictions and really understanding, you know, the human mind and how we form habits and how we can break those habits. And, you know, after about 20 years was really seeing some clear patterns that were, you know, it's like this repeatability of, you know, habit formation, whether it's, you know, straight up addiction, you know, like alcohol, cocaine, heroin, pills, smoking, but even seeing how that was the same pattern of habit formation around social media, which was the same around getting distracted, which was even the same around getting caught up in our own ideas and thinking, and even romantic love. And when I saw all of these come together, you know, this really crystallized, you know, like a big aha for me. It's like, oh, there is something common here. And at the same time, I was studying how we could affect change. And it turned out that ancient Buddhist psychologists had a pretty good solution that directly applied to all of these things. And so the first half of the book is about, you know, how we get caught up in all these types of addictions, if you want to think of it that way. And the second half is around how we can actually tap into that same reward-based learning process and hack our minds, if you want to think of it that way, to break free of these habits. It's a pretty remarkable system.
So when you sort of refer to them as addictions, I mean, that can be really any habit, can't it? Because aren't all habits addictive in quality?
They can be. I like the simple working definition of addiction being continued use despite adverse consequences. So, you know, our smartphones can be extremely helpful. I find mine really helpful when I'm trying to navigate the streets of Boston, which is pretty difficult to navigate. Yeah. Yet at the same time, if I'm answering texts and tweets and while I'm driving, that's pretty dangerous. So there's some adverse consequences that can happen from that.
Okay. And your interest in this field, I'm just interested in your personal story for a second. Did that come because you had certain addictive qualities in your life that you were sort of trying to navigate and work through at that time?
Unbeknownst to me, yes.
Okay. I mean, because I've had my fair share of addictions, and certainly I feel I have a highly addictive sort of personality. But as I've really sort of taken the time to pause and reflect and assess the mind and these addictions, I've allowed that space just to create some awareness. And even though I still acted on certain desires or habits, over time, as the pause became more predominant, and as I questioned what I was doing with more clarity, I managed to reverse some of these addictions and habits. And certainly that's been quite powerful in my ability to, you know, self-mastery. And I'm certainly not a master of the self yet, but I can certainly see the benefits from just taking that time and becoming more aware.
That sounds very parallel to what I was discovering as well. You know, I had no idea that I was addicted to, you know, like a lot of things until later I woke up to how much suffering they had caused or were continuing to cause. And that awareness was really critical for changing the process, you know.
And I think it comes to that first point of awareness, like where you're doing something and unconsciously or subconsciously you're doing it without really knowing what the consequences of doing it are, like smoking cigarettes. I mean, I smoked for many years and, you know, I guess I always knew what was bad about smoking, but I never really gave it the time or attention. And so therefore I wasn't really aware of what I was doing. I was just doing it, even though, you know, everyone knows that it's not the best thing to be doing. And it wasn't until I really created that awareness that, and the desire that I wanted to make a change, that it started to happen. And even though I failed many times in the process and continued for many more years, it eventually did come to where I could break that habit. And that's what's really crazy about these desires, these habits, these addictions that drive us. They almost drive us uncontrollably, even though against our will, we desire, you know, other things.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you mention that, because one, you know, we can know things in our head, you know, we can know them cognitively, but that's not really what what drives our behavior. It's that, you know, that urge that comes from our body. And so we can, you know, we can understand something in our head and know that it's bad for us or good for us, and yet it doesn't really hold water compared to, you know, the drive that comes from within our body. So the other piece is we can't really trust, you know, that thinking part of our brain, the prefrontal cortex, because it's the first part of the brain that goes offline when we get stressed out, which is one reason that people smoke. So it really has to move from knowledge to wisdom, you know, this embodied awareness, before behavior is actually going to change. And then it can really change pretty quickly if that awareness is really, really strong.
Okay. And that's all. I want to go into a lot of those points more, but let's start maybe with how habits, you know, form it. And, you know, you talked about the reward for what we do that causes us to form these habits or addictions. Can you just explain that briefly for us?
Sure. I think the simplest way to think of it is we think of it as reward-based learning. So it takes three components. One is a trigger, second is a behavior, and the third is a reward. And this process was set up evolutionarily so we'd remember where food is. So if the trigger is we see food, the behavior is that we eat the food, and then the reward literally is a signal that goes from our, you know, into our brain that spritzes dopamine in the nucleus accumbens that says, hey, sugar, you know, calorie survival. And so there's this memory that gets laid down that says, remember what you ate and where you found it. It's a context-dependent memory formation process. Yet the same thing gets hijacked with anything that spritzes causes a dopamine spritz in the same brain region. So any drug of abuse causes the same thing. Talking about ourselves, getting likes on Facebook, these have now been shown to cause the same dopamine spritz. So we can start getting addicted to Facebook. We can start getting addicted to social media. And we also get addicted to, you know, eating cupcakes when we're stressed out, because our brain uses the same learning process. You know, you get stressed, you eat a cupcake, and you feel a little bit better.
Yeah. So anything that makes us feel good based on our biochemical hardwired nature to survive, I guess, can certainly be the reason why we form certain habits.
It could be, and it's really interesting. The good feeling is, you know, that feeling of excitement, right? Societally is, you know, we say, oh yeah, that's good. You do a roller coaster ride, and that was fun. But if we look at it more closely, you know, really bring awareness to it, there's this restless quality that comes with excitement that says, oh, this was awesome. You know, make it continue. And if we can start comparing that to other states of being where, you know, for example, joy or peace, you know, those don't have a restless quality to them. And if we can line them up side by side and we say, well, excitement, which has restlessness, versus joy that doesn't, you know, where does our brain naturally start to move? You know, for me, it's toward joy. And so now there's this differential where I can see, well, there are actually higher levels of happiness that I might not have noticed before when I thought excitement was the best that it got. And now my brain says, you know, maybe that was set up just so you'd remember stuff as compared to trying to go for it again. And then suddenly the picture gets really interesting.
So we're not, I mean, we all go towards these things that give us that pleasure, you know, that rush. And it seems to be ever expanding. It's like we can't just be at peace with without it. And I think that's what drives most of us to continue seeking out new pleasures and doing things that perhaps aren't conducive for our longevity or survival, but because they bring us pleasure, we go after them. But, you know, is that about reducing the cravings then? Is that the sort of premise behind the book?
That is. So if we can see it clearly that we're constantly driven by our cravings and that the consequences as well as the drive itself don't actually feel as good as some of these other joys, then our brain will naturally start to recalibrate itself and say, you know, smoking that cigarette, that's not as great as I remembered, or eating that sixth cupcake, you know, maybe I could stop at one. And it's not a cognitive thing. It's that embodied wisdom that says, you know, I'd rather hang out in this place where there's joy, where there's ease, as compared to the place where I was formerly hanging out in excitement land.
Right. So, yeah, some things obviously are quite, you know, bring us on that same pleasure, but are quite, can be quite stressful, I guess, in pursuit, whilst other things that can bring on that same pleasure can be quite peaceful. As far as where these, I don't know, are they desires, where these desires arise from? I mean, I believe that, you know, I feel that some are innately within us for that hardwired reason of survival, but I feel some of our desires are just brought up by an emotion, which I don't know if comes from the same place. Am I correct in saying that, or is there more insight you can give us on that?
Give me an example. We can unpack it a little bit.
Well, like if I want to, you know, obviously the need to survive, I get hungry and I desire to eat some food to fulfill that need. So that is hardwired into me. I eat, it gives me pleasure. So therefore I can remember it next time and I can continue to move towards food. But if an emotion comes about, so let's say I'm sad because I just broke up with my girlfriend, I might seek to heal or express or subside that emotion by going after eating that I mm-hmm. remember also or associate with pleasure as well. So whilst one is satisfying a need to survive, the other is satisfying an emotional need, but both are the same actions. One is going to be conducive to our survival, one is really not necessary.
Right, because eating doesn't actually help us go through the grieving process, let's say.
it's just to sort of numb it or express it or whatever it might be. I think there's a variety of different ways we might act to, deal with our emotions, but they're not necessarily going to help.
Right, and I see this a lot in my psychiatric clinic with working with people with binge eating disorder, where they've often described this state where they'll just eat to numb themselves from their emotions and numb themselves from their feelings. And not only does it just distract them, you know, for the moment, but also many of them become morbidly obese because of it, because they just, you know, they just keep packing on the calories.
It's an easy out, an easy escape.
Yeah.
So what, I mean, do they arise from different spots then? I mean, you know, is it just because we associate pleasure with eating based on our initial need for survival that we go towards those things because we remember them as being pleasurable?
Yeah, I think it naturally, we get, if you want to think of it as reward creep, Yeah, it creeps from a survival reward. And I think that, you know, that dopamine spritz, somewhere historically, that contracted quality that comes with that was named happiness, right? So somebody actually traced this, don't quote me on this, but somebody traced this back to Shakespearean time where this excited thing became named happiness. And then, you know, in modern day, the marketing people picked up on that. They said, oh, we can make you feel inadequate and get you motivated to buy our stuff and there, you know, and call that happiness. You know, when you buy something, therefore you're happy. Yet when we really step back and look at it, we can say, is that really the best definition of happiness? You know, happiness is a pretty obscure, or not obscure, but it can mean a lot of different things to different people. Absolutely. So if we really unpack that experientially and we separate out, okay, excitement from joy, well, now we can start to see the difference. And we can see that one just makes us want more and feeds that habit loop, whereas the other is, you know, joy is just joy. There's nothing more that it needs. It's not driving us to do anything else.
Yeah, is there a sense of complacency or passivity that can come from that joy? I'm just interested in where the balance between ambition and that's it's like a, you know, a state of comfort and joy and peace. It's really, as you say, without that restlessness or stressful qualities of the pleasure that we seek, it's about being content with what we've got. But I mean, where is the balance, and is there a risk of complacency in seeking joy?
Yeah, it's a great question. In my own experience, where when I'm in a state of joy, I'm actually very connected with whatever I'm doing, and it's often times where I'm very productive and when I'm very engaged and very active. I've not found joy does not generally coincide with being a couch potato for me. So I think it's actually quite the opposite. There's this connectedness with the world. And I'd say the highest level of joy that I've experienced and others have described is this, is the flow state where, there's the sense of self is completely gone. It's kind of the doors are blown off. There's not even a concept of self when there's just awareness and a flow through life. And that's immensely joyful.
Yeah, I'm interested in that too. So describe to us what is the flow state? It's a concept of not being attached to the self or being selfless, I guess.
Yes. So there was a psychologist, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who coined this term, I think back in the 1970s. Hmm. And some of the conditions that he described were that it's selfless, it's timeless, it's effortless. And so just concretely speaking, if we were to anchor our experience around fear, for example, so if I were to ask you, is fear, if you had two choices, is fear contracted or expanded, how would you say, your experience when you're fearful, would you say it's contracted or expanded?
Geez, I don't know. Contracted?
Yeah. And that's what almost everybody that answers that question says. And so now compare that to joy. So fear contracted, does joy feel contracted or expanded?
Expanded.
Yeah. So if we take those as our calibration tools for our experience, if you take that expansion, well, let's start with contraction. So contraction literally says, hey, this is me, right? I'm contracted so I can feel where my boundary is between myself and the world. If you take that into the joy and you take that expansion to infinity, where are you? Where is the self? You can't find that boundary, right? Mm. So this is at least my conceptualization of what Csikszentmihalyi talks about is, there's this expanded quality of experience that goes so far out that there's no sense of self. And in that, there's just awareness of what's happening. And it's magical, for lack of a better way of putting it. And then there's just stuff happening and awareness of stuff happening, whether we're playing sports or in an activity or simply resting in awareness. That internal narrator that often goes along with fear that's saying, oh, that's good, that's bad. Oh, you screwed that up, or oh, you did a great job with that, that has that contracted thing that comes with it. That narrator is gone because there's no someone narrating. There's not even, that part of the brain activating. So my lab has actually, studied experienced meditators to look to see what happens as we kind of stop getting caught up in that sense of self, if you want to think of it that way. And we see that there are networks in the brain, called the default mode network, that get deactivated during, absorptive concentration states. And even we've had people trip into flow and we can, we can see these brain regions getting deactivated in real time. Mm. And these are the same brain regions that we and many other groups have found get activated when people are getting caught up in their experience. So there are even neural correlates of what we're describing in our experience right now, with regard to, you know, the if you want to think of it as the experiential self, that contracted state, and then flow, which is the expanded state that moves, you know, to infinity, if you want to think of it that way.
Right. Yeah, very, very complex. I love it. What, how do we go beyond self then? How do we, you know, move beyond that contracted sense of self and into that expanding self? Is it an expanding self, or is it just without self?
Well, I think it depends on how far it's expanded, right? So if it expands to infinity, then we can't find that boundary. And I, you know, I think of it more now as less of a binary, you know, self versus not self. I think people can pop into flow, and then, you know, that expansion is really popped quickly. But in most of our lives, there's this constant fluidity where we're either contracting or expanding. So we might be becoming more fearful in any one moment or less fearful. And so we might be contracting or expanding or letting go. So that's generally how I've been conceptualizing it. And I think this is where we can hack the reward-based learning process. This is where it gets really, really interesting. So first off, we can start to see what it feels like when we're constantly chasing that next high, or that, you know, or that last high, or that quality of craving, which is supremely contracting, that says, do something. And we can just start to pay attention and say, what does that feel like in my experience? Oh, it's actually painful. And what do our brains do when something's painful? They say, oh, I don't want to do that. And so even bringing awareness in that moment to seeing how painful something is starts to move us in the opposite direction, even a little bit. Oh, we let go a little bit. Simply that awareness helps us let go, you know, because we're less identified with the object.
Identified with the object and the reward. I guess they're hand in hand, are they?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And so we see the reward isn't as rewarding. So our brain starts to recalibrate and say, well, why would I want to be contracted down in that state? And then it starts looking around for, oh, well, you know, here when I'm being generous, for example. So when we're truly being generous, is it contracted or expanded? What's it feel like?
It'll feel expansive because you're thinking about the self.
Yeah. Yeah. You're literally letting go of something when you're being generous, right? You're giving. You're giving up something. And when somebody's generous to us, we even feel that as well. You know, it's like, oh, thank you. Wow, that was really kind of you. And then there's this expansive quality. Same thing with humor, right? Oh, when something's really funny, we're not contracted down like a neutron star. We're expanding. And so our brains can naturally, they can start being on the lookout for what causes contraction, what conditions support expansion. And then we can start finding the conditions that support us moving in the direction of flow as compared to in the direction of contraction, of getting caught up in ourselves.
It's really fascinating stuff, isn't it? It's, I mean, it's really the key to being more purposeful with your thoughts, with your actions, with what you say, think, and do, is understanding that nature of the experience and what is contracting, what is expanding, and then moving towards that. And then going back to my earlier question about, you know, ambition versus complacency. And certainly in my experience more recently, certainly I've noticed this sense of calmness in my life, that I'm still, you know, working on certain projects and activities, but I'm not uncomfortable about life. I'm not pressured or stressed about what I'm doing, and I seem to have removed a lot of the unnecessary stuff that doesn't give me that purpose. And I don't know if that's because of what we're talking about now or not, but it certainly seems to resonate at the moment. Mm.
Great. Yeah, so you can even explore that more. It sounds like you're in a pretty good place.
At the moment, like, yeah, and I'm really, for me, and I'd like to explore, you know, your experiences with how we can go about, you know, and I guess it's through the awareness and mindfulness, but just exploring that expanding, those expanding qualities, those expanding desires and rewards, rather than, you know, going chasing after the the contracting ones, because I've recently, and I'm making a decision now in regards to my life and which way I'm going to move next. And it's a really hard decision, because both have good positives and both have their own negatives. And certainly when I reflect on them and sort of think about them, there's certain qualities of one in particular that seems to be more contracting to my life, and it's certainly not one I want to move in. But a part of me, and I think it feels like it's more a part of me that's attached to sort of an ego that I sort of see as an attachment to an external definition, seems to be driving me back towards that area. But I know from my life perspective and how I want to live my life, it doesn't seem to be the one, in your terms, expanding. It's not expanding to the quality of my life. It certainly seems to be like it'll be more contracting. Does that make sense?
It does. It's worth paying attention to, eh? Yeah.
So what, I mean, as far as mindfulness goes, you said you started off a mindfulness practice, meditation, some time back. What techniques have you learnt and come across that might help our listeners really just create that awareness to help us move beyond, the habits that are driving us that we don't want to be driving us?
Yes, I've learned a lot over the years, a lot of different practices, and certainly had started out classically in the Theravada Buddhist tradition, learning about breath awareness and learning things like body sweeps or body scans, and doing a Burmese practices such as these noting practices where you note your experience from moment to moment, and then even playing with some of the Tibetan practices like Dzogchen tradition. And I would say now, especially looking back, it's really interesting. I've been really trying to force things for many years. I was trying to force things and really learned that the forcing was part of the problem, because I was trying to meditate and I was trying to focus my mind.
That's interesting now, you say that, the force thing, because I've talked about that for a couple of years now in relation to trying to force the things that are outside my control to be within my control. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, it doesn't work so well, does it?
No, it's never worked.
So when I woke up to that, feedback, that doesn't work so well, it opened up a new door to say, what if we just create the conditions that support concentration? And, the answers have been around for thousands of years. There's this early Buddhist sutta called the Anapanasati Sutta, this mindfulness of the breath, where they describe these seven factors of awakening. And, the first time I learned it, it was this list of things, it's like, oh, this list doesn't make sense. And then I looked at it again and it was like, oh, no. These are actually taught as a chain of causation where it's like rubbing two sticks together. You take the first two. The first one's mindfulness, awareness. And the second one can be translated as like interest or curiosity. And so if you bring awareness to something and you get curious about it, let's use an example of like reading a book. So you pay attention and you get interested in reading a book. Now, that interest naturally brings about energy. So that's actually the third factor of awakening, because we become energized. We start reading this book and suddenly we're like totally into it, which leads to the fourth factor, which is rapture. We become enraptured and joyful. It's like, wow, this is a great book. And then this leads to the fifth factor, which is tranquility. Like we can sit and read for hours without moving. And then this leads to the sixth factor, which is concentration. And then that leads to the seventh factor, which is equanimity. So if we look at this as a chain of causation, just bringing conditions together, everything else comes along. So in my early practice, I've been trying to force myself to concentrate, when in reality, concentration is six steps down the road. The reality is, if you just get interested in something and pay attention, concentration will naturally arise. If you look at children, they can get fascinated with a blade of grass for a long time. They're naturally concentrated. So
they're not caught up in that whole self thing.
Yeah, yeah. So this is a radically different way of looking at things. It's like, oh, just see if you can get curious. If you're not curious, get curious why you're not curious, and suddenly you're curious, and it helps bring awareness. So, you know, so I look at practice very differently now. I love this phrase, short moments, many times. So if we can rub those two sticks of awareness and interest or curiosity together in any one moment, it can help us really be with whatever's happening, even if in that moment it's unpleasant, right? Oh, well, what's unpleasant feel like? And that, oh, is not so bad. We can actually be with unpleasant more than we were able to a moment ago when we were habitually trying to run away from it.
Mm. Well, I like it. And I'm just going back to that reading thing. Like at the moment, I sit in the hot bath and read a book for about half an hour in the evenings. And I know myself when I'm actually paying attention and really curious about what I'm reading compared to when I'm not. And when I'm not, I'm just like, I don't know, just flicking pages mindlessly without even taking in the content that I'm reading. Whereas when I'm focused and curious, I'm just in there and suddenly time just disappears. And I guess that sort of, I love it, that awareness and curiosity leads to that sort of state of flow where you just, that voice of the self just sort of shuts off.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like we're driving the car with one foot on the brake and suddenly we pull our foot off the brake and the car lurches forward without any effort.
Yeah. Well, I look at the analogy of floating down the river, and for much of my life, I've been floating in that river, trying to paddle against the current rather than just letting go and just flowing with it and sort of just, you know, creating, as you said, the conditions to direct where I'm going to flow. Rather than trying to go against it all the time. And certainly that seems to be where it's going, and it's quite an experience. Quite an enjoyable experience. As far as those cravings going, and you know, because certainly I've found, and look, giving up cigarettes for me was something that was quite liberating, and I haven't really shared it with my audience yet, but it was quite liberating because I found just a greater sense of control and ability to, you know, control these desires. And that has really helped me with many disciplines in my life, and certainly helped me be more mindful and present, which certainly I think has added to the quality of my life. But as far as, you know, many of these cravings go, I mean, where do we stop with cravings? Where do we stop with these things that bring us, you know, some sort of pleasure? They may not necessarily be the greatest things for us, but I mean, how much is too much, and where is it a matter of, you know, self-acceptance and self-denial, like, you know, enjoying an ice cream, etc.
Right. Well, it's really interesting when you talk about control and cravings. You know, when we try to control our cravings, good luck, right? It's like trying to paddle upstream. We just get exhausted until we let go, and then we succumb to them. So there's a paradox here, whereas if we let go and we think that we're going to totally get sucked into our cravings and go down, you know, go over the waterfall, and we have this, you know, we have this Eat Right Now program where we're training people to change their relationship to their cravings around eating. And one thing that we say to people is go ahead and eat, you know, and they're like, I might eat a million calories. And we say, go ahead and eat. and there's this tremendous freedom in letting go of that rule that says, I shouldn't eat, you know, I shouldn't do this. You know, it's like we can stop shooting all over ourselves and really say, just pay attention when you eat. So if you eat one piece of chocolate, what's that like? Okay. Now eat a second piece. Now eat a third piece. And when you're on your 10th piece of chocolate, you know, oh, wow, my stomach's pretty sick. That doesn't feel very good. So we can naturally learn, you know, one piece of chocolate tastes, it's a lot better than eating 10 pieces of chocolate. And so we naturally gain control through that disenchantment process with moving from paying attention to eating habitually or mindlessly. And so the paradox here is, the control comes through letting go. That's crazy to some people. Yet, and when they start doing it themselves, they're like, oh, wow.
Well, and it's about creating a different, is it? Or maybe it's not, but I feel it's about creating a different sense of reward from the counter desire that you wish to create, and you know, that's finding pleasure in being without, perhaps.
It is. So we're moving from external rewards, right? So if I eat cupcakes, I feel good through that excited, you know, chasing that excitement, okay, to if I simply rest in awareness and get curious, that curiosity is an internal reward and feels better than feeding that craving.
Yep, I like it. Mate, a lot of it makes sense to me, and it's certainly relevant in my life at the moment. Hopefully it's you know, of value to the audience. I'm sure it will be. Is there anything else in particular you want to sort of mention before I jump into these other questions?
I'll just mention, you know, we covered a lot of territory here, and that's what a lot about what the book The Craving Mind is about. And the other thing I'll mention is that, you know, the book lays out the foundations of how we can change our habits. Yet we're finding, you know, the research that we're doing is that we're finding that giving people bite-sized trainings through, you know, digital therapeutics is really helpful. Mm-hmm. So I think of it as, you know, combining the book to get the theory and then, you know, taking a pain point like stress eating or emotional eating and diving into an app-based training is where people can really take that, you know, take that to the bank. So I'd just like to say, you know, that's what we're finding is a good way to solidify the theory into action, where, you know, somebody reads the book, for example, and then uses one of the apps like the Eat Right Now app or the Craving to Quit app that we use for smoking cessation.
Yeah, look, it's certainly something I wish I stumbled across several years ago, because it might have been my journey of trying to create my own theories and figuring things out. But look, so you've got the is it goeatrightnow.com, the Go Eat app?
Yes.
So that's goeatrightnow.com and cravingtoquit.com.
Mm-hmm.
So one's for eating and one's for smoking, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, cool. I'll stick that in the show notes, guys, so you can check that out at thehiddenwhy.com. And also the book as well, The Craving Mind. Mate, it's absolutely a pleasure getting insight from yourself and your expertise. So I appreciate that and thank you. I've got some questions I want to ask you, ask all the guests on the show. So we'll just jump into these before we wrap it up. And the first one I want to ask you is, do you have any routines or rituals that you believe contribute to your success?
The biggest one is paying attention. The more I can get in the habit of paying attention, the better things are. And getting out of my own way. Two are related, obviously.
So what is your meditation practice? What do you do daily to find that space?
My wife and I meditate together in the mornings, just doing, you know, some formal practice. And I also try to take it off the cushion as much as I can, you know, short moments many times throughout the day. Really just looking for, is there a moment where I'm contracted versus are there conditions that support, you know, this letting go? And even now, it's just like bringing that awareness right to the contraction. That contraction is so painful that it naturally starts to open up. So it's a combination of a formal practice plus, you know, informal practice throughout the day.
Yeah, okay. And what advice would you give your 20-year-old self?
To notice how painful it is to try to feed that ego.
Right. And what's your meaning of success?
That's a great question. I would say helping decrease suffering in the world.
Why is that important to you?
You know, it feel, you know, I've certainly had success in other ways throughout my life, and none of it has felt as rewarding as being connected and being helpful. And there's just so much suffering in the world. It's just so painful. I see all sorts of disconnection all the time now. It's, you know, it just seems like that's really, you know, that's what to me just over and over again is most rewarding, is how can I be helpful?
Yeah, nice, mate. I love it. I can certainly relate to that. And have you got a piece of productivity advice that you'd like to share, something that you do to make you more effective in the day?
Well, one thing I would say is turn off all the distractions, you know, like the email bleeps, the all the things that pull us away from the present moment habitually.
Yep.
Until we can learn to train our own minds.
Yeah, cool. Any advice to someone wanting to make some change in their life?
Learn how your mind works.
Very good advice. What's your favorite food?
Oh, I have many. I like dark chocolate. I like dark chocolate and dark. Yeah. So dark chocolate right now.
Do you have a particular diet?
I'm vegetarian.
Vegetarian. Yep. Any reason why that's a choice?
You know, at first in college when I started exploring vegetarianism, it was purely out of health reasons, you know, trying to improve my sports performance and just energy levels. Since then, it has also moved for ethical reasons to be vegetarian, and then also environmental reasons now. So there are kind of three reasons that go together for being a vegetarian, all three of those.
I like it. And do you have a favorite leisure activity? It sounds like you're into your sports.
I love mountain biking. That's probably my favorite, yes.
Actually, I remember you talking about that in a TED Talk you did, and you you mentioned about and you're going down the hill,
yes,
in that rush, and you get into that flow state where the self just disappears.
Yes, so mountain biking, trail running, especially trail running downhill, great conditions for flow.
Yeah, I've got to find some more of those activities too. I like it. And have you got a favorite book that you'd like to recommend for the audience?
Oh, there are many. One that I liked recently is called The Art of Racing in the Rain. It's told from the perspective of a dog.
The Art of Racing. Do you know who that's by?
I don't remember the author's name, but the author described as he went through the book, you know, as this amateur race car driver, or the dog's talking about his owner, who's an amateur race car driver. Mm. And the amateur race car driver was obsessed with this guy named Ayrton Senna, who was a Brazilian Formula One race car driver. And I have to say, Senna is amazing. I watched a documentary called Senna that describes his life. And I think Senna really knew how to get into flow. You know, one thing about him was when other race car drivers, when it started raining, the race car drivers would contract with fear, like, oh no, I'm going to slide off the track. And Senna, I could just imagine he'd get this big, you know, grin on his face and he'd just tear it up because he would just, you know, he would just totally become one with the track and just blow everybody away. So the book kind of describes, I think that's the title of the book, is around, you know, the art of racing in the rain, which kind of, you know, highlights Ayrton Senna, this amazing race car driver.
Interesting stuff, huh? Like, yeah, in those situations when you get caught up in the self, it can often veer you off course and make you crash, I guess. As it relates to life, I mean, that certainly seems to be what happens.
Yes, literally.
is there a sense like of the self or the ego even that is purposeful in how we live our life, do you think?
That's a great question. You know, I could give you some baseless speculation, some BS, but I don't really know.
I sort of feel there is personally, but
yeah. There was probably, you know, it's probably helpful, and at least from what I understand, that sense of self probably emerged somewhere around agrarian times, and it was probably helpful for us to plan, you know, for, you know, planting and harvesting crops that don't, you know, magically emerge the moment you plant the seeds, and then probably helped us survive, you know, somehow in communities. And, you know, I'm sure it's still helpful. Everything's a balance. Yet when we get too caught up in ourselves, you know, YouTube should be called MeTube. when we get too caught up in ourselves, it's not so helpful.
Yeah. Interesting stuff to explore. And do you have a favorite quote?
Oh, man, that's a tough one. There's so many great quotes. You know, I love the one from Einstein who says, you know, I have no special talents. I'm only passionately curious, I believe. That's a great one.
Mm. Very cool. And do you believe we all have a why?
Great question. I think so. And I think that's like, you know, it can be expressed so many different ways, but I would even say it's that, you know, that interest or longing or curiosity around, you know, that, whether it's the why of existence or the connection with the greater, or, you know, all of that. I think so, definitely.
There's some internal deep sort of curiosity about life or some aspect of life.
Yes.
Mm. And what does living life with passion and purpose mean to you?
Flow.
Great answer.
Flow.
So, Judson, mate, thank you for coming on the show. How do people best connect with you and find out more about your works, etc.?
I have a completely self-referential website that's called judsonbrewer.com that really, I think that's got links to everything. So our, you know, our apps like the goeatrightnow.com and the craveandacquit.com, as well as my book, as well as the web, you know, my research. So I'm the director of research at the Center for Mindfulness. And so there's a link to the Center for Mindfulness. So that's probably the easiest way for people to have, you know, kind of a resource for all of those things in one place.
Mm. Very cool. I'll stick that in the show notes, plus all the other links and your book as well. So guys, check it out at thehiddenwhy.com. If you want to pick up a copy of that book, please use the link there in the show notes as well. Help support the show here at The Hidden Why. Judson, any final comments?
Thanks for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
It has. I've enjoyed it deeply, and you've just made me want to go and sort of sit and reflect now for the rest of the day. So I appreciate it, mate, and I appreciate your time. Thank you. And guys, check out the show notes at thehiddenwhy.com. And until next time, peace, passion, and purpose. See you soon. Gang, another episode on The Hidden Why. Thank you for taking the time out of your day to tune into this episode and any of the other episodes that you might be listening to as well. Guys, I appreciate you coming back and really appreciate your support as well. Guys, if you love the show, if it's bringing you some value, some inspiration, some thought, stuff to inspire you to live life with greater passion and purpose, I always love to hear from you. So you can do that in a number of different ways. Number one is going to thehiddenwhy.com and leaving your comments in the show notes there. Or you can reach me directly at thehiddenwhyguy@gmail.com. You can also find me on Facebook, Twitter, and reach out to me in that manner as well. Guys, there's a few ways you can support the show if you do love The Hidden Why and the content that I produce here. I would ask you, number one, you can support the show by jumping onto iTunes and leaving us a review there. Number two, you can always share the shows with your network by Facebooking or Twittering them out. If they are such words, I guess Twittering must be. So you can do that by sharing the love with your network, with your families, with your friends, etc. You can also use the Amazon links at thehiddenwhy.com. There's down the side of the page, there's Amazon and Audible links. You can do all your shopping through Amazon links there, and that just helps support the show as well. So guys, thank you again for tuning into the show. Please support the show as suggested, and I would love to hear from you as well. Thanks again. We'll talk soon. Until next time, peace, passion, and purpose.